I want to thank Cis for the kind introduction. The memories of Pesach are warm for me as well. And I thank everyone for being here. I want to take special opportunity to acknowledge both my parents and my in-laws who are here. We just, they would have come just for the Yom Iyun. As it so happens, we were able to plan a bar mitzvah around the Yom Iyun, and therefore they were able to combine the best of both. I also want to just begin with my sincerest apologies for my delay. The bumper-to-bumper traffic over the last 15 minutes when we were 1 kilometer away, I should have expected, but two different accidents on Highway 1, I'm sorry, but that I couldn't anticipate. So I do apologize for my delay. The only thing I can do about it now is make sure that the shiur made your wait worthwhile. And for that, I will do my best. I picked as my topic, as we are just a week or so away from Parshas Zachor, and of course, the holiday of Purim, to discuss the relationship between Mordechai and Haman, but with specific focus on the perennial battle that the Jewish people wages with Amalek, which at this point in Jewish history found its concentration and its focus in the dynamic and the confrontation between Mordechai and Haman. But as we know from the Tanakh, and as we know from subsequent events and stories and sources in our tradition, this is perhaps the very famous interactions and confrontations between the Jewish people and Amalek, but really should not be seen in isolation. And therefore, what I'd like to do, again, in the deference to the next speaker, I'll do my best to abridge my remarks. But what I'd like to do is I would like to focus on one specific question, which in theory is perhaps both a textual as well as, you could say, perhaps even a philosophical issue that is in the Megillah. And then I would like to use that as a springboard to discuss our relationship, what the Jewish attitude is supposed to be towards Amalek, with a specific eye towards a moral dilemma that I believe this issue raises for all Jews. If you take a look at your source sheet, and again, we'll use the source sheet liberally. I prepared all the sources fully for those of you who would like to look on, not only while I'm speaking, but to take home afterwards. But in deference to time, we won't read too much of the sources inside. But if you take a look at just the first three sources, I have summarized for you the three classic locations and mentions of the Jewish people's confrontation with Amalek before Megillas Esther. In source number one, you have the narrative of the Jewish people leaving Egypt. We know that shortly thereafter, as the Pasuk tells us in Shmos and Perek Yud Zayin, completely without provocation or warning, Vayavo Amalek v'yalachem im Yisrael berefidim. They attacked us. Yoshua led a battle which was miraculously inspired by Moshe's raised arms. And as the Torah tells us, Baruch Hashem, we defeated Amalek. Later, towards the end of the Torah, towards the end of Sefer Devarim, we have the particular mitzvah, not only having been told that we have to continually wage war to destroy Amalek, but now in Sefer Devarim we are told not only that, but Zachor es asher asa lecha Amalek. It's not only enough to fight Amalek, and that's a perennial battle, but we must also remember Amalek. Perhaps independent, the connection between the mitzvah to remember and the mitzvah to wage war is actually a debate. But that's not our topic today. We have two mitzvahs, Mechiyat Amalek, in response to their unprovoked attack, as well as Zechiras Amalek, remembering what they did for us. This story takes place, or finds the second act of this story, occurs later in the Tanakh, one more time before Megillas Esther, and that is the direct confrontation which is instigated at the behest of HaKadosh Baruch Hu by Shmuel HaNavi, using the instrument of the first king of Israel, Shaul HaMelech. And in source number 3 in Shmuel Aleph in Perek Tezvav, we are told that Shmuel tells Shaul, almost immediately after having been anointed the king, that Hashem has told him that I still remember all those years ago what Amalek did to my people, to the Jewish people, and therefore he says, you are commanded in Pasuk Gimel to attack Amalek, to destroy them. And here we have a reiteration of the command already from the Torah to have no mercy, to destroy everyone and everything, including the animals, and certainly all of the men, women, and children. And the Navi tells us in the middle of the paragraph in Pasuk Zayin that Shaul did that with one famous exception. Shaul let the king live. Agag, Melech Amalek, he let live a short period of time that he was in jail before Shmuel HaNavi gets word from Hashem. Hashem tells Shmuel, I am furious at Shaul, he has rebelled against me. Shaul loses his monarchy over this mistake. He gets severely criticized by Shmuel at the end of the story in the Pasuk Lamed Gimel, at the end of source number 3. We are told that Shmuel HaNavi, the great tzaddik, brutally kills himself. He kills Agag. But according to our tradition, in that small window of time, from the time that Shaul was merciful to when Shmuel enacted HaKadosh Baruch Hu's actual judgment and command, in that small window of time, somehow Agag was able to cohabit with some woman, and in fact the seed, the legacy of Amalek perpetuates. And we then meet up again with the descendants of Amalek in Megillas Esther. And that's the source that we have in source number 4, when we're confronted with the initial interaction between Mordechai and Haman. And of course Haman throughout the Megillah is referred to as Haman Ha'agagi. He is a descendant, he is a grandson of Agag. Would it not have been for Shaul HaMelech's mistake, there would have been no need for Purim, there would have been no need for a miracle, and there would have been no close call, no brush with death for the Jewish people of Shushan. But Shaul HaMelech's mistake rears its head, and we are confronted with an implacable foe, what has been known even throughout the centuries since as one of the symbols, perhaps, I would say without a doubt, in the top 5 of our arch enemies. And that's saying something, because we have enemies. So to be in the top 5 of the Yiddish enemies, this is already a compliment. But Haman achieves such a state, Haman Ha'agagi. I want to bring your attention as a springboard for our discussion for the remainder of the shiur to the confrontation that the Megillah first outlines for us in the beginning of source number 4. This is in the 3rd chapter, Paragimel of Megillat Esther, where the Megillah tells us after Haman have already Vashti's been replaced and all that stuff, and Haman has been elevated, and the Megillah tells us that Haman has been promoted. Who is he? He's Haman ben Hamdasa Ha'agagi. And as a result, in Pasuk Beis, we are told, whenever Haman would walk by, everyone had to bow down to him. Kain Siva Lo HaMelech. He had the imprimatur of King Achashverosh. However, at the end of that second line, Pasuk Bet, we are told very famously, Mordechai lo yichra lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai would not bow down to Haman. Of course, the king's servants, Haman's servants, everyone noticed this. This became a cause celebre. Everyone noticed this and was talking about it. And as a result, they asked him, Madua ta'over es mitzvos ha-melech? Why are you? Again, it's not just disrespecting Haman. By disrespecting Haman, you're disrespecting the king, you're disrespecting Achashverosh. But as a result, one thing leads to another. Ominously, we are told at the end of Pasuk Dalet that Haman is informed, Higid lahem, Mordechai has told them, Asher hu Yehudi. I'm not bowing because I am a Jew. Of course, this raises the question, well, if that's the reason not to bow, what about all the other Jews who apparently did bow? You say, well, maybe they were just the commoners and they were weak. And it wasn't just the other commoners. The other chachamim, the other members of the Sanhedrin apparently bowed. Mordechai was the only one who didn't bow. So it's a double-edged question. What was wrong with bowing? And if it was so wrong that Mordechai refused, why did everyone else bow? And of course, the section ends with the ominous and the terrifying result that Haman is furious. And again, on a personal, individual level, the rage is almost understandable had it been limited to Mordechai. But of course, the anti-Semitic and irrational tone of the hatred becomes clear immediately, as we are told at the end of the source, the end of Pasuk Vav, V'yevakesh Haman l'hashmid, not just Mordechai, but as kol ha-yehudim, asher b'chol malchus achashverosh, Mordechai. What did they do to him? Nothing. But if Mordechai is a Jew, I'm going to kill all of them. Again, something that unfortunately we've seen many times throughout our history, even if, and we of course aren't judging Mordechai to have done anything wrong at all, we'll get to Mordechai's behavior in a moment, but even if and even when there's an indiscretion or a mistake or even an injustice perpetrated by an individual Jew, this was certainly not the last time we have seen our enemies take vengeance, not against the perpetrator, but against all Jews. For what reason? No good reason. But this is just part of the history of the Jewish people, Haman perhaps being the first and maybe the most well-known, but certainly not the only perpetrator of such a vicious and vicarious evil let out against a particular Jew and then the Jewish nation. So I want to spend just two or three more minutes before we transition to the main and final section of the lecture to try to ask a question which could be asked both from a perspective of Tanakh, a literary question, but I'm mainly focusing on it almost as a philosophical or a halachic question. What was so wrong about bowing to Haman? After all, Chacham Einav Barosha, everyone else is doing it. Haman is almost all-powerful. Ahasuerus is literally all-powerful, and this is his kingdom, and he's commanded it. What is Mordechai doing? And again, I beg, again, just for you to think about, the stronger and more obvious you think the answer to that question is, then the more you'll be confronted with the follow-up question is, what are you going to say about all the other Jews, including all the other Chachamim? And if there was some heter, some petach, some kula, some shita out there that the rest of the Chachamim were hanging their hat on, well, you know, if we hold like this one and like this one, you know, we could put together two things and make a kula. So then why didn't Mordechai rely on it? Was it impetuous? Was it a religious arrogance? Was it short-sightedness? Or is Mordechai really the hero that we're brought up to believe? So in fact, again, this is not a Tanakh shir, and we're not going to be spending all of our time focused just on answering this question. But you should know that it is not our question, and there's nothing wrong with asking a question. This is the question that Chazal themselves asked, both in the Gemara and Masechet Megillah, as well as in a number of Midrashim. If you take a look at source number 5, the Gemara asks in a very straightforward way, Mara Mordechai d'iknei b'Haman. Why did Mordechai provoke Haman? Even the language of the question almost puts Mordechai on the defensive. Why provoke Haman? And the traditional answer, but it's traditional and it's vague and ambiguous, and we'll have to explain it in a moment, says the Gemara, the Shav Yenavshe Avodah Zarah. Haman made himself an Avodah Zarah. But what does that mean? And again, I reiterate, if it's so black and white, so then we have a real question against everybody else. So we're really caught between a rock and a hard place. We want to defend Mordechai. On the other hand, we don't want to have to throw everyone else under the bus. So what's going on? So in fact, if you take a look at the Mefarshim, and to boil it down, we'll just read source number 6. It's a Yalkut Shimoni. Rashi and the Ibn Ezra weigh in on this as well in sources 7 and 8, and there are slight nuances between them, but I think the richest picture of various views is included in source number 6, the Medrash in the Yalkut Shimoni. Says the Medrash in the first opinion, Yesh Omrim, source number 6, Nasan Elohav Bekelov, that somehow Haman sewed into his clothing or hung around his neck or attached to his garment some idol, some Avodah Zarah. And therefore when he would walk by, if the Jews would bow down to him, they would also have been bowing down to an idol. Now they may not have had in mind to worship Avodah Zarah, but it certainly would look as if you have Jews bowing down to an idol. If this would be a Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin Shir, we would discuss, is this technically Avodah Zarah? Is this Maris Ayin of Avodah Zarah? Is it Abizrayah of Avodah Zarah? All sorts of halakhic categories. But somehow, for our purposes, what's important is it was in the Mishpacha of Avodah Zarah. What does that mean? Was Haman a god? No, Haman's not a deity. Haman had some kind of an idol sewn in or hanging onto his clothing. However, the Medrash continues and sheds a slightly different light on it. The Medrash continues at the end of the first line and says that Mordechai said to himself, Ani, eini yachol lahachnif l'rosha hazeh. How could I flatter, chanifa, right? That's like flattering. I know all sorts of other slang ways of saying that, but we're in a shul. But, you know, people do this, right? They talk nicely to people who they think are in power. So says Mordechai to himself, how can I give this excessive flattery to Haman after all? Shani ta'un signon shel melech. After all, you know who I am? What my lineage is? What did the Torah say? He's a descendant of Binyamin. What did the Torah say about Binyamin and the brachos to Binyamin, etc., etc.? And therefore, he says, if you skip down two lines, Amar lo, have you odeh she'ata. Excuse me, we'll stop for that one second. So that's the second approach, which seems to be more of a almost a nationalistic debate, a power struggle between Mordechai and Haman. In fact, the Medrash in the third line indicates that unlike the simple understanding of the Megillah, which seems to imply, as we read it before in source number 4, that it was the Avdei HaMelech, the servants of Ahasuerus, who asked Mordechai, why aren't you bowing? If you look on the fourth line here of the Medrash, it sounds like he's talking about his fellow Jews. Look what it says here. You have to be sensitive to the nuances of language. Omrulo, they said to him, questioning his behavior. But who's the they? Listen carefully. Hev yodea she'ata mapilnu becherev, mapilenu becherev. Mara'ita levatel chavasim shel melech. You are going to make us fall by the sword. You're putting us in danger. Well, who do you think is speaking now? Avdei Achashverosh? Doesn't sound like it. Exactly. According to this opinion in the Medrash, the Pasuk is not alluding to the servants of Achashverosh looking out to protect their master. It's his fellow Jews. And some of Drashim say it was specifically the other Chachamim. How dare you, Mordechai? What religious arrogance! You're going to be machmir in this. You're putting all the Jews in danger. How dare you? So Mordechai responds, Ani Yehudi, but I'm a Jew. So they said, well, so? After all, are you going to tell me that there's no precedent? And here, as you'll see as we continue in a moment, it's clear that at least according to this opinion in the Medrash, there was no Avodah Zarah. Because perhaps what it meant is not that there was an idol around Haman's neck, but rather, what does it mean he made himself a god? Saddam Hussein made himself a god. Would that be Avodah Zarah? All sorts of leaders, right? Their egomaniac is not the same thing as Avodah Zarah. Right? You remember when they invaded Iraq, they had these big pictures and busts of Saddam Hussein everywhere. And it's probably common with tyrants throughout the world, right? So, it's not Avodah Zarah. It's a question of power and ego gone wild. So, the Chachamim apparently felt that that's why it was mutter, because it wasn't Avodah Zarah. And they say to him, and you'll say, well, Jewish pride, Ani Yehudi, how could I bow to him? But didn't our forefather, Yaakov Avinu, after he was coming with his children, on his way back to Eretz Yisrael and his wives and his children, who confronts him? The famous confrontation with Esav. And he davened and he split his camp and he did all these strategic things. But what does the Torah tell us when Yaakov saw Esav? He bowed down to him multiple times as a show of honor, scared for his life. So the Chachamim say back to Mordechai, how dare you? You think you're better than Yaakov Avinu? He also did it. Shenemar v'yishtachu arta sheva pamim. So listen to what Mordechai says back to him. He says, yes, Yaakov is the eldest Zeta. But who's my real grandfather? His son, Binyamin, and Binyamin didn't bow. So say, what kind of business is this? If the father, Yaakov Avinu, was bowing, you think that the one son, the little baby, he thought he was firmer than everyone, he didn't bow? So you just have to know your biblical chronology, as the Medrash tells us. Binyamin wasn't born yet. Rachel was still alive. When is Binyamin born? After this, when they get to Beis Lechem, and of course Rachel dies in childbirth, according to our tradition, and Binyamin is born. They're already back in Eretz Yisrael when Binyamin is born. So says Mordechai, according to this and other versions of the Medrash, number one, my grandfather didn't bow. I'm a descendant of Binyamin. And number two is, of all of the Shvatim, I come from the one that was born in Eretz Yisrael. And there's a special yichus, having been born in the land of Israel, and a special higher standard for a Jew who was born in Israel. I'm from Binyamin, I'm from Rachel, I was born in Eretz Yisrael, and we don't bow. Fascinating. So perhaps it was a real Avodah Zarah Shaila, that makes Mordechai more understandable, but it really questions everybody else. Perhaps it was this gray issue, it looked like Avodah Zarah, it really wasn't, it was a question of Jewish pride, and I don't think it was. Really, there's no reason whatsoever, chas v'shalom, we should look at this as Mordechai being arrogant. What I think he was looking to do was something which we know from our modern idiom and our contemporary culture. He was looking to reinstill Ga'ava Yehudit. Because as we know, Jewish pride. Because we know from many other sources in the Medrash about the Megillah and the story of Purim, was rampant assimilation. According to many traditions, the Suda of Achashverosh wasn't just a hedonistic, you know, club med indulgence. That would have been bad enough. The sin of the Jews that they enjoyed Achashverosh's feast. But according to many traditions, the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash were being paraded. The big day of the Begadim of the Kohen Gadol were being worn. And what was the basis, according to Chazal, for the whole party of Achashverosh? Because according to his Cheshbon, according to his calculations, the Navi's prediction of a second Beis HaMikdash had expired. Time had run out. He kept on being worried, oh no, maybe Hashem's going to take the Jews and take my monarchy away from me. Ah, Baruch Hashem, you see, the Navi who said it'd only be 70 years, it's not true. I'm the king, I'm all powerful, let's make a whole party and to lord it over everyone. I'll ridicule everybody by taking the kalim of the basement. You can imagine, right? They're using like as a beer keg, you know, the menorah. And they have the big day Kohen Gadol they're dancing on the tables with. So that's bad enough. But the Jews went to the party. Have you no pride? Is there any sense of Jewish identity? And apparently the answer was no. They were not on such a high level. And who was fighting the war, not only against Haman, but first and foremost against his fellow Jews to stand up and remember, who are we? Ani Yehudi, says Mordechai. We don't bow down and we're not giving up. So if you take that approach, it's a very fascinating debate between Mordechai and other Chachamim. On the one hand, you have this tyrant who, again, doesn't take much of an imagination to realize that if you rub him the wrong way, this could go wrong. And the other Chachamim say we need to take a conservative approach. We can't confront Haman head on. Maybe, you know, discretion is the better form of valor. And you have Mordechai on the other end saying, no, we must confront him. Now is the time to draw a line in the sand and I will not bow. So that's a complex debate. Easy to look at that in hindsight. It's always easy, as we say, to Monday morning quarterback. But to make the decision in real time, that's where greatness and true leadership comes from. In fact, in source number 9, the Maharal, the famed Maharal of Prague, in his commentary on the Megillah, the Maharal asks the question. And the Maharal doesn't duck. The Maharal doesn't hide behind other Jews or Jews of that generation. The Maharal asks the question head on. Who gave the right? Who told Mordechai it was the right decision to endanger the entire Jewish people? And in fact, the Maharal gives an answer, two answers, which are very similar, whatever their differences are, but there's a similarity to the two answers, which raise the stakes all the more so. If you go back, the Maharal, again, the Maharal is known not as a biblical mafarish, but more as a philosopher. But again, a good philosopher, he's grounded in the language. If you go back just for a moment and you look at the Megillah, in source number 4, when it says that Mordechai did not bow down, if you look again, look at source number 4 on your sheet, at the end of the second line where I have it underlined, U'Mordechai lo yichre v'lo yishtachaveh. Who knows Diktuk well enough to tell me, what tense is that sentence, that phrase in? Okay, excellent, very good, it's in the future. So, that's not how I translated it. That's not how anybody translates it. Not Art Scroll, not JPS, not even the fancy, you know, Tanakhs. We translate it, he didn't bow. Because that's clearly the theme of the narrative. But says the Maharal, think about it, it's in Lashon Atid. It's in future tense. Look at source number 9. Why would it say that way? So the Maharal's first answer is, Shlo na'aseh pam echad, ela harbei pamim. It doesn't mean future in the sense of he didn't do it yet. The future, and it wasn't a one-time thing, it was a multiple-time thing. Furthermore, he says in the second answer, perhaps even more provocatively, Av shahaya yochol Mordechai leilech derech acher, shaloya pogebo, v'lo yichos haman, haya Mordechai holech neged haman al das shalo yichre, v'lo yishtachaveh. Not whether it was multiple times, that's not the focus, says the Maharal in the second answer. Rather, he says, let me ask you a question. You think it's just a coincidence that every time Haman walked by, Mordechai just happened to be there and not bow? Says the Maharal, Mordechai went out of his way. Mordechai found out where's Haman going to be, and he ran there so that everyone would bow down and he would stand up. He was sticking his finger in the eye of Haman. He was looking to provoke a fight. Now I ask you, does this have any seichel? You could understand why the other Chachamim are upset at Mordechai. Once you got caught, you know, you didn't know what to do. All sorts of stories over the generations, even in recent times, of rabbis who were caught. And, you know, there's a story even after the, I think they say about Rav Aaron Cutler, maybe, I think it was after the World War II, he was somewhere where the Pope came and everyone bowed down by the Pope and he refused to bow. Other such stories, all sorts of times where people are confronted. Okay, one time you get caught, you know, you should do, you shouldn't do. But every time, again and again, to look for trouble. Says the Maharal, yes. Because Mordechai understood each time was a Kiddush Shem Shamayim. The Jews will not bow down. We are not giving in. We are not assimilating. We will stand strong and stand proud. Whether you look at it as a nationalist perspective, according to the second approach in the Medrash, or you see it as a straight religious, theological issue. Everyone's compromising about Avodah Zarah, but they should know there's at least one Jew who will keep us standing. One way or the other. But still, it begs the question, why go out of the way? Why do we, and I would say this story of Mordechai, especially as understood by Maharal in a microcosm, symbolizes, I think, the big question that's kind of the elephant in the living room, which I want to now spend the next 20 minutes to conclude the shiur focusing on, and that is the following. Why do we have such a confrontational approach to Amalek? In microcosm, Mordechai is looking for trouble time and time again. Where is Haman? How could I? In his face. So, writ large, we've had lots of enemies. Is there any other enemy about whom we have a mitzvah of mechiyah to destroy? Lahashmid, laharog, la'abed? Think about it. What Amalek did to us after we left Mitzrayim, terrible. Was it worse than what Paro did? Was it worse than what Nebuchadnezzar did? Was it worse than what Titus did? Yet only one nation is singled out for such an aggressive, militaristic attitude, and that is Amalek. Let's put the question in an even more sensitive light. What are we talking about here when we talk about Mechias Amalek? Macho Emche, destroy Amalek. What was Shaul HaMelech commanded to do, what Shaul HaMelech wouldn't do, ultimately? There's a word for it in English. Genocide. Ethnic cleansing. Hayitachin, the Jewish people, with what we've been through, we should have a mitzvah from the Torah to do such a thing? Why such an aggressive attitude? It's not just Mordechai. Mordechai wasn't in a vacuum. Mordechai emerged from our tradition. Mordechai was Gadol HaDor. Mordechai understood that we have this confrontational attitude towards Amalek. But that doesn't answer my question. That begs the question, why? In fact, if you take a look at source number 9, the Gemara suggests that this was in fact what stopped Shaul. Why did Shaul carry out the command? He got it directly from Shmuel HaNavi. So Shaul, according to the Gemara in source number 9, doesn't say, well, you know, on the news on Sunday morning, you know, the pundits won't talk nicely about us. You know, in the Liberal Academy, they'll talk bad and they're going to boycott Israel. Shaul HaMelech asked the question from the Torah itself. Killing Amalek runs counter to Jewish values. After all, says Shaul HaMelech in source number 9, we have a mitzvah called Egla Arufa. We have a whole tekes and a whole ceremony with the leaders of a city. If one anonymous Jew is found dead somewhere outside the city, we don't know who he is, who she is. So we have a whole thing, and it's a whole ritual with kapara and begging for forgiveness for one life. That Torah that's sensitive to one life, kol mukayim nefesh achas, is going to tell us to wipe out a whole world? And what does the Gemara say Hashem answered? The last line on the front of your page? Yotza basko v'amra al tihi tzadik harbe. Shalom Melech, don't be such a tzadik. Don't think you're so frum. Don't think you're going to out frum HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If this is what Hashem wants, then this is what you got to do. But tell me honestly, is that an answer? Right, just substitute your children and you. But mommy, why do I have to go to bed? Because I said so. Okay, we all do it. But it's not answering the question, it's avoiding the question. So I'm asking you, why was Shaul wrong? Again, don't misunderstand me, I take it as axiomatic. If Hashem says to do something, if the Navi says to do something, of course it's right. But Torah, tell me, help me understand, why was it right? Why is this a Jewish thing to do? If you turn over your sheet in source number 10, you see a little snippet of an article that was published 12 years ago, now almost 13 years ago, by a good friend of mine, Rabbi Yitzchak Blau, who lives on Alon Shvut. And he pointed out, in the course of a much bigger article about other topics, but he pointed out from a number of Mefarshim, whose credentials, whose tzaddik credentials, no one would question, like the Chazon Ish, like Rav Avram Grudzinski, who's not nearly as well known, but he was the Mashkiach, the spiritual supervisor of the Slobodka Yeshiva at the time of the Holocaust. Great, great tzaddik in pre-war Europe. And the Chazon Ish, Gadol Hador, who both say that this mitzvah, of course, is a mitzvah, but it runs counter. It's the exception. It runs counter the Jewish values, against the Jewish nature. The Kaf HaChaim, the great Sfardish posek, asked, why is there no bracha on the mitzvah of Mechiyas HaMalek? The answer is, he says, because we cannot make a bracha on such a mitzvah. Do it, though we must, but not make a bracha on killing. Amazing, powerful, right? This is not, as I say, some threatening, questioning from the outside. These are from the inside. Shol HaMelech, Chazon Ish, Kaf HaChaim. Again, not questioning it, but we need to understand it. How could it be the Jewish tradition, which is filled with so many, we just read Parshas Mishpatim last week, 40 plus mitzvot, mainly mitzvot ben Machavero, the first one with the Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri is the lowest rung of society. He's a ganav who can't repay what he stole. And even he we have to take care of with respect. And we're supposed to kill all of Amalek? What's the pshat? So I don't have justice to go, don't have time, excuse me, to do justice to the question. But you should know that there are a number of Mefarshim who've asked this question in one way or another way before us. And I gave a number of the answers for you on the sheet. I want to run through a few of them just to give you the highlights. And then I want to conclude with some contemporary reflections in ways which I think will hopefully make this in a way personally meaningful to all of us. One of the first, if not the first, to ask the question directly is the Ramban. Nachmanides, the famous commentary on the Torah, one of the greatest scholars that we had of the medieval period, of the Rishonim. And the Ramban, in source number 11, in his commentary on the Torah, he doesn't ask it in a Q&A form, but he's clearly bothered. Why is it that we have an Onesh of Amalek, as he says, more than all other nations? How come? So he says very simply, because Amalek didn't just wage war with us. They waged war against the Rabbanu Shel Olam. What do you mean? Because it says shortly before that, we even say, you know, from Az Yashir and from the Torah before that, that when the nations of the world heard about Kriyat Yamsuf and what happened to the Egyptians, they were all trembling in fear. No one would touch these people. They may have been a ragtag bunch of slaves, but they clearly had God on their side. No one would deign to even think about coming near them. But, says the Ramban, Amalek ba me mirchak kemitgaber al Hashem, says the Ramban. They came to fight, not the Jewish people. What did the Jewish people have for them? Nothing. They came to fight the Jewish people as a proxy war. We think, in our geopolitical world, we talk about the proxy, Mitzad Hara. Right? Hezbollah is a proxy of Iran, and Syria is a proxy of this one. But it's true in reverse. The Jewish people are also a proxy of the Rabbanu Shel Olam. Says the Ramban, for no reason whatsoever, when everyone else was tittering, everyone else was scared of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says Amalek, Karcha Baderach, I'll cool it off. Nothing to be afraid of. Nothing there. Just keep on walking. Nothing special. Who are these people? Nothing. You don't have to fear them. We'll show you. We'll attack them. Their God's nothing. They got lucky in Egypt. Maybe it was just a wind and a tornado. They attacked them. Says the Ramban, we're not looking to revenge what happened to us. But you mess with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're opening up a hornet's nest. And that's what happened to Amalek. Perhaps approach number one. Abarbanel, living somewhat afterwards, of course, the famed 15th century Mefarsh, also from Spain. Of course, as we know, he was a courtier in the court of King Ferdinand. Eventually, he tried very hard, but ultimately unsuccessful, to stave off the Hispanic expulsion at the end of the 15th century. Abarbanel has a very long, Kedarko Bakodesh, very, very long essay on this. I just gave you the highlights. But he says, he focuses on the Jewish people. What did the Amalek do to us? What was so bad? He says four things. The fourth is really a little bit against Hashem, the truth is. But at least three of them are against the Jewish people. Sometimes you hear about, and this is actually originally a Catholic idea, but it's, at least in America I could say, it's been co-opted into mainstream discussion, a concept called just war. In the civilized world, by which I mean, you know, not the Middle East, in the civilized world, so there are rules when you go to war, how you go to war, some of the rules are written, some of the rules are unwritten, but there's a certain concept of a just war. Says the Abarbanel, that was true in the ancient world as well. But Amalek violated everything. Number one, says the Abarbanel, usually there's a good reason to go to war. Either it's a defensive war, that's the best reason, or even it's an offensive, but there's something that they want. You want. You're not just evil. You want the land, you want the oil, the natural resources. Says the Abarbanel, the Jewish people had nothing. We had no land, we had no resources, we still have no oil. We had nothing. Well, maybe we have gas now. Okay, we had nothing. They had no reason. There was no good reason to attack us. Violating the basics of war, number one. Number two, even worse, he says, Tam Hasheni, that even when people go to war, Kodem Boem Lilachem Ba'arechad Yodi Loivehem, they tell them we're coming. Put your dukes up. Hirni Bali Hilachem Itchem. Right? Now we have a different kind of war, maybe, but at least in the ancient world and until relatively modern history, right? Two armies confronted each other on the battlefield. You knew they were coming. It was a fair fight. But what does it say about Amalek? Not only did they surprise us, who did they attack? The weakest among us. Totally unjust. Even in the ancient world, this was an avla. You don't do fight like that. Number three, says the Abarbanel, also against the Jewish people. You know what else they did? Some of you may remember, you may have learned, even when you were a kid, or more recently, the famous Rashi, how come a ganav is worse than a gazlan? What's a ganav? Well, let's say it better. What's a gazlan? Gazlan is a bulvan, he's not scared of anybody. In the middle of the day, he goes into the bank, put your hands up, give me the money. He ain't scared of God, he's not scared of the teller, he's not scared of the police, nobody. That's a terrible thing. You know what's worse, say Chazal? A ganav. What's a ganav? Somebody who sneaks into your house in the middle of the night. Because he sneaks into your house because he's scared of you, scared of the police. But Hashem could still see. The same Hashem who saw him during the day could see him at night. So he's worse because he's making his fear of human beings more severe than his fear of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Says the Abarbanel, that's also what Amalek did. Because who did they attack? Again, they attacked the rear, the weakest, the women and children, the ill and the infirm. Why did they do that, says the Abarbanel? Strategically, they wanted an easy target. So again, they're more scared. What about God? Aren't they scared of God? Isn't God on the Jewish people's side? That they didn't scare of. But Yoshua they were scared of. Kolev they were scared of. The tough Jewish soldiers, the IDF, they don't want anything to do with. But civilian targets, buses, a malchamal, kindergartens, people sleeping in their houses on a Friday night, that's where they attack. They're more scared of our soldiers than they are of our Kaddish Baruch Hu, says the Abarbanel. This is also an avla. So the three different ways he adds, and the fourth one he also says, similar to Ramban, they all fought against God. But even those three ways, the way they treated us, it's true, we treat them differently than we treat everybody else. But they started. They treated us worse. Rav Hirsch, in source number 13, says something amazing. I wish I had more time to dwell on it. But Rav Hirsch doesn't really address the primary question that we have, but he does discuss it on a more symbolic level. And he points out that even though we have this mitzvah to obliterate Amalek, the Torah couches it in the following phrase. We have to obliterate the memory of Amalek. Timchas Zecher Amalek. So if you want to just read the Chumash straight and literally, I think the explanation is, really wipe them out. Don't leave any memory of them. But that's not how Rav Hirsch understands it. In source number 13, he understands it symbolically. You know what we're trying to defeat? It's not so much Amalek, but as he puts it, Amalekus. Amalekness. The memory. What does he mean by the memory? Says Rav Hirsch, amazingly. How will Amalek go down in history? How will the evildoers be remembered? Timch es Zecher Amalek, says Rav Hirsch, our battle is not just with the people who did the evil, but it's with the legacy. How will history be written? Even before Winston Churchill, Rav Hirsch understood this. Who writes history will determine the future. How history is written. Says the Rav Hirsch, the key is not just defeating Amalek, that Hashem could do easy. What does Hashem need us for? How will the human race remember Amalek? Amalek were bad guys. Wicked, they attacked civilians, they attacked women and children, bad people, evildoers. So says Rav Hirsch, well, how will they go down? If they are celebrated and lionized, that guarantees one thing. Flattery will lead to imitation. There'll be more terrorism, there'll be more attacks, more evil. But, says Rav Hirsch, our job as Jews is Timchez Zecher Amalek. Make sure the world calls a spade a spade. Make sure evil is called evil. Not for our sake, but for the future of the whole human race. Says Rav Hirsch, and that's why it says, Kiyot al Keska, that Hashem joins the battle, and Hashem's name is not complete until Amalek is destroyed. It doesn't just mean that there's some guy running around in a robe who's from Amalek. He can't stop Hashem's monarchy and Hashem's rule of the world. But how is Amalek and everything that Amalek represents understood if they're given a legitimate place in the UN? I'm paraphrasing, of course. If they're lionized in world opinion, then the zecher of Amalek is strong. That compromises in a direct confrontational way HaKadosh Baruch Hu's monarchy and influence in the world. But if, says Rav Hirsch, we, through our actions, don't just defeat their armies, but Timchez Zecher Amalek, we make sure that everyone understands there's nothing to respect here, there's nothing to imitate here. This is a losing proposition. If a world, halavai, it sounds utopian because it is, but if there would be a world in which good is rewarded, when nice guys finish first, when people who do the kinds of things that Amalek does are called for it, not only defeated, but discredited. That's the battle that we have, and that's the uncompromising battle. If it would be just a military thing, no, we can have a little Rahmanis here, a little Rahmanis there. But this is not a military battle alone. This is a spiritual and philosophical battle. This issue became very relevant, unfortunately, in recent times, not only with, most immediately with our confrontation with terrorism, but of course, generation and a half, two generations ago, of course, in the Holocaust. And in reaction to that, at a Mizrahi convention, not long after the founding of the State of Israel, Rav Soloveitchik gave a famous address in which he, among other things, quoted a tradition that he had from his father and his family, and that is that you shouldn't think, I said before, ethnic cleansing or genocide. So Rav Soloveitchik, Amalek is not just a family. Amalek is not just a tribe. Amalek is not just a people. It is. There was a historical people. But based on a close reading of the Rambam, which we do not have time to go into now, Soloveitchik says in the name of his father that in fact there's a second aspect of Amalek, and that is an ideological one. The ideology of Amalek, he says, is anyone who, through their maniacal hatred, just wants to destroy the Jewish people. Anyone who says we are committed to the destruction of the people of Israel because we hate them, because we want to destroy them, period. Not because we're fighting over some land. If that would be the case, that's bad, but that's not Amalek. Amalek wants to destroy us because any people, doesn't matter if they're Mitzrayim, Ashur, Girgashi, Nazi, Arab, anyone, says Rav Soloveitchik, his words, not mine, who takes that banner of we want to destroy the Jewish people, we are enemies of them, we want to destroy them, they have a din of Amalek, says Rav Soloveitchik. In fact, again, without digressing too much, he was for this reason against taking war reparations for the Nazis. He held the Nazis had a din of Amalek, and one of the halachas of Amalek is you're not allowed to have benefit from them, you're not allowed to take gifts from Amalek. Now, needless to say, the Prime Minister didn't pass him like Rav Soloveitchik. But just to show you, he really meant this. This wasn't just an allegorical flourish on his part. He meant it. There's an aspect of Amalek in any people, whatever, you can trace them back to Esav, to Yishmael. It's not a bad genealogy, said Rav Soloveitchik. There's an aspect of Amalek called the ideology of Amalek. And that also, I think, helps a little bit with the dilemma that we may face. It's not that we're not just looking for innocent people. We're looking for people who embrace this all-consuming hatred, and they are avowed enemies of us. We're not looking to cause the trouble. But again, to paraphrase Mordechai from the beginning of this year, Ani Yehudi, we're not backing down either. Someone who's an avowed enemy of the Jewish people deserves the full wrath of the Jewish people as well. I just want to conclude with two references very briefly from Harav Aaron Lichtenstein, Shalita. Rav Lichtenstein, in two different essays, addresses a general concern about Amalek, and then on a very personal level, which I think will hopefully be relevant and inspirational to all of us. Number one, Rav Lichtenstein points out something amazing. He says, at the end of the day, with all the answers and explanations I just gave you, it's schwer. It's difficult. As the Chazon Ish said, as the Kaf HaChaim said, still, this is not exactly the most Jewish kind of a mitzvah. Can we really, really do that to another people? The answer is yes. But why? So says Rav Lichtenstein, the only way such a behavior could be legitimated is if a person is 100% kulo, the shem shemayim. You're only doing it because it's tzivoy Hashem, not because of bloodlust, not because you like playing with guns, not because it's cool to be a soldier. You're doing it because this is Ratzon Hashem. We may not understand the tzivoy Hashem. Lots of things we don't understand in life, but we accept it as a tzivoy Hashem. Says that was the problem with Shaul HaMelech. We asked, what was wrong with Shaul HaMelech? Rav Lichtenstein gives a brilliant, in my opinion, explanation. He says, what's pshat that Shaul HaMelech left the king Agag alive? So he says, if Shaul HaMelech had only been motivated by Hashem said, so that he wouldn't have had mercy on anybody, because Hashem said, kill everybody. Once he had mercy on Agag, which Rav Lichtenstein understands was a kind of a king to king, royal to royal, monarch to monarch kind of sympathy. Once he did that, whatever the cheshbon was, what he was doing was substituting his personal ethics for the ethics of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says make no exception, and therefore Rav Lichtenstein something fascinating and almost radical. It says Shaul HaMelech was not killed, or to be not punished, for not killing Agag. He was punished because by not killing Agag, that showed that everyone else who he did kill was because of his own personal cheshbon. No matter how good and clever you are, no personal cheshbon can legitimate wiping out a whole nation. The only thing that can legitimate it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ratzon. But if that was the case, then he would have killed Agag too. By not killing Agag, that shows that Shaul had substituted his own morality, and that morality clearly was corrupt. I conclude with everything else. Some of this may be persuasive to you, and some of you it still may kind of rub the wrong way. Whether it does or doesn't, we're looking to understand. And I'll leave you, I'll just paraphrase an amazing thing. Many, many years ago, Rav Lichtenstein wrote a one-page essay. It was originally published in the magazine Jewish Accent, and it's been republished in a two-volume work of his philosophical essays called Leaves of Faith. It was called The Source of Faith is Faith Itself. One-page essay. It's worth Googling if you don't have the book. It's worth buying the book. Also, amazing, amazing essay. And in the course of that essay, Rav Lichtenstein speaks autobiographically. How often do we have Gedolei Yisrael speaking autobiographically about their emotions, about their own personal struggles? It's very rare, and therefore it's a treasure whenever we have it. Says Rav Lichtenstein, when he was a teenager, he was bothered by the moral dilemma. How could the Torah command us to destroy men, women, and children, all of Amalek? I was also bothered by things as a teenager, but not Amalek. But that's why I'm not Rav Lichtenstein. So Rav Lichtenstein, as a budding tzaddik, as a teenager, is bothered by this. And then he says he remembers reading the following, and I believe he read it in an essay from Rav Soloveitchik, who years later would become his father-in-law. Rav Soloveitchik said about his grandfather, Rav Chaim, the great-great Gadol Hador, Rav Chaim Brisker, you shouldn't think that problems with teenagers and stuff is only new in our generation. In Brisk, said the Rav, there were so many kids born out of wedlock who were abandoned that every morning when Rav Chaim Soloveitchik woke up, he would go to the front door to see if anyone had dropped a baby off by his doorstep. Because not just to look and then, you know, shry and have an asifa, anti, you know, boys and girls. No, because Rav Chaim took the kids in and raised them. So says Rav Lichtenstein, when I thought about that, I said, you know, I sleep very well at night. I'm not looking to see about all the injustices of the world, about all the kids who are nebuch, need help and abandoned in poverty. If a sensitive, spiritual soul, a kind-hearted person like Rav Chaim, who couldn't sleep at night because of abandoned kids at his doorstep, if he can live with Amalek, then apparently whatever qualms I'm feeling aren't because I'm more sensitive, more moral than Rav Chaim, but perhaps I'm just lacking a little bit of his Yirah Shamayim. He says, and I spend the rest of my life trying to fix that. It's a tremendous humility. If there's no other essay you ever read from Rav Lichtenstein, it's worth it just to read this one essay. But with this, I conclude that as we've done our best in the brief time that we have to try to understand the Torah's approach to the confrontational attitude, not only of Mordechai, but the Jewish people with Amalek. I think there are many insights which are worthy of serious contemplation. But at the end of the day, we must remind ourselves that it is the exception, not the rule. Judaism is not a religion like others of murder and bloodlust. On the contrary, we are the religion of Mishpatim, of Gomlei Chasadim. Yes, there are exceptions. Yes, we accept them as the Ratzon Hashem. And if we would ever be called on to do them, we hope we'd be up for the challenge, unlike Shaul. But nevertheless, we have to realize that the struggle to understand is not a sign of weakness, but a sign of greatness and spiritual strength. And even as we struggle, if we can concomitantly at the same time bow our heads and accept that which we don't know, inspired by people even greater than us, who've also said we accept when we don't know, that is not only a way of approaching this issue, but really, I would say, a mashal, a paradigm for all of religious life. Thank you very much.